Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Laveau of Creighton University's Department of History. It may come as a surprise to some that the current debate over violence and sexuality in Hollywood films began decades ago, when, allowing for changing sensibilities over time, films were every bit as violent and sexual as we now see on the widescreen. Many complain today that the motion picture code is too weak, that it is not vigilantly enforced. In the early 1930s, there was no motion picture code at all. In a moment, we'll talk about that era with film historian Thomas Doherty. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. This week, in 1882, German physicist and Dr. Robert Koch discovered and isolated the bacillus responsible for tuberculosis, paving the way for the more effective treatment of that and many other deadly diseases. Koch began his study of bacteriology in 1866 by examining anthrax, a fatal cattle disease. While the bacillus for anthrax had been discovered years earlier, scientists were still confused by its behavior when in isolation. Koch studied it and summarized the results in what became known as Koch's postulates, a framework used by bacteriologists ever since to determine whether an organism is the specific cause of a particular disease. He isolated the tuberculosis bacillus in 1882 and then became one of the first epidemiologists to emphasize the importance of clean air and water in protecting large populations from virulent diseases. Koch was awarded a Nobel Prize in 1905. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, archaeologists have discovered a massive underground tomb near the Bahariya Oasis in Egypt that is estimated to hold as many as 10,000 mummified bodies. What is even more surprising is that, unlike most earlier discoveries, the mummies in the tomb appear undisturbed by looters ever since their entombment in the 3rd century BC, when Alexander the Great ruled Egypt and most of the known world. During Alexander's reign, mummification was no longer the exclusive preserve of the rich, but a ritual among more common folks as well. And the Vietnam government plans to turn a bitter remembrance for Americans into a national highway. The Ho Chi Minh Trail, used by the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War to funnel troops into the South, will soon become a two-lane highway connecting population centers in the North to Ho Chi Minh City in the South. The road, which must be carved out of the same dense jungle that served to protect troop movements during the war, is expected to be completed in 2003. You're listening to Talking History. There was a time when there were even fewer controls over the motion picture industry than today. It's known as pre-code Hollywood, and that is the subject of Eileen Dugan's interview with film historian Thomas Doherty.
Mention of 1930s Hollywood cinema evokes images of Busby Berkeley musicals, sophisticated comedies, and westerns in which good always conquered evil. But, especially in the early years of the decade, there are more explosive images of gangsters unchecked by police, of exotic women preying upon man after man, of vice unpunished and triumphant. Why were so many films of the 1930s so filled with the violent, the sexual, the lurid? And what efforts were made to sanitize Hollywood movies in their wake? With us today to discuss the underside of 1930s American film is Dr. Thomas Doherty, chair of the Film Studies Program at Brandeis University. Professor Doherty is the author of the recent book Pre-Code Hollywood, Sex, Immorality, and Insurrection in American Cinema, 1930 through 1934. Welcome, Professor Doherty.
Hey, good to be here.
We often hear references to the code, but apart from thinking about it having to do with sex and the late Hedy Lamarr running around naked, we tend not to know what it was really about. What did the code involve?
Well, the code was, rather than, say, a list of prescribed activities like running around naked, although it was that too, was basically a moral vision. that the production code wanted to make sure that Hollywood taught the right lessons, and those lessons tended to be things like the virtuous are rewarded, the guilty are punished, and that civil and moral authority are always upheld. So it isn't just sort of prescribed language or images or, you know, gore, the kind of things we laugh at and are really easy to signpost, but it's a much broader sense of the world being moral and ordered that Hollywood promulgates under the production code.
And who wanted this done?
Well, a lot of people wanted it done, or at least a lot of elites and religious organizations who thought that the messages Hollywood was sending, particularly in the early 1930s, were too salacious, too violent, too immoral, too chaotic for cultural well-being, particularly the cultural well-being of young people, because they thought that that although adults can watch images of violence or sexuality and not be adversely affected because an adult's moral character is formed, a young person going to the movies seeing these things is going to be adversely affected because he's an impressionable youth who hasn't got a sturdy religious upbringing yet. So women's organizations, religious organizations, and a good deal of editorial newspaper editors and educators, the kind of groups that today you wouldn't think of as being pro-censorship back in the 1930s, looked upon the movies as a basal influence.
You focus upon the years 1930 through 1934 because you make the point that actually there wasn't much being done to crack down upon these movies that were a little more salacious. I mean, why was it that the code was being violated so willfully?
Well, in 1930, the code is actually written. The phrase pre-code is something of a misnomer, because anything before the onset of censorship in 1934 could be considered pre-code. But the film scholars and film programmers tend to date the era from 1930 because that's the date the production code document, which, you know, gives all these this list of prescribed activities and the moral vision, is actually written. It's written by a Jesuit priest named Father Daniel Ward. But it's not got an enforcement mechanism until 4 years later. You know, the censorship is being done in Hollywood, but the people doing the censoring are the movie moguls themselves. So it's really a paper tiger until 1934 when it's given a strict enforcement mechanism. And most crucially, it's given a chief in the form of a guy named Joseph I. Breen. And when Joseph I. Breen takes over the Production Code Administration, which is formed in 1934, that's when you see the movies turn on a dime. That's when the movies go from being this sort of chaotic pre-code universe into what we think of as that, you know, classical Hollywood cinema of moral order and tempered behavior.
Well, let's talk about this wild, unbridled universe for a moment in the movies. In your introduction, you make reference to the wildly eccentric films, how they were more unbridled, fallacious, just plain bizarre compared to what followed. And can you give us some examples of those?
Of sex or bizarreness?
Oh, whatever you like.
Well, one of my favorite movies of unbridled sexuality of the era, in fact, a lot of people, two movies, are Jean Harlow and Red-Headed Woman, and Barbara Stanwyck in a film called Babyface. Red-Headed Woman was from MGM in 1932, Babyface from Warner's the next year. And in both of these films, these women sort of play these immoral vixens who sleep their way to the top, you know. And of course, the way they do it and the language and the attire is very salacious and licentious. But I think what's more odd about them from a production code perspective is that neither of these women is really punished for her behavior. At the end of Red-Headed Woman, Jean Harlow has a millionaire French husband and a chauffeur lover played by Charles Boyer, and that's how the film ends, after she's slept her way to the top. And Barbara Stanwyck pretty much thrives the same way. She works her way up through a savings and loan company one floor at a time, and and a wealthy woman. That film actually has an attached-on kind of production code ending, which nobody believes, which she's a little bit punished, but the entire 80 minutes of the film validates her behavior. For bizarreness, I think one of the best examples might be a film like The Island of Lost Souls, with Charles Laughton as the evil doctor. It's one of the first versions of the famous H.G. Wells short story, in which he's breeding a tribe of half-animal, half-humans for trying to get them to procreate with a man. And that's the kind of thing you're certainly not going to see after 1934.
Yeah, that latter movie was recently remade as The Island of Dr. Moreau, as I recall.
Right, that was the original title, but I think at the time they changed because they didn't want people to think it was a medical story.
But it's interesting how we... It's interesting, though, how we tend to associate 1930s women with Katharine Hepburn, the strong-willed character, and yet even she would appear in some films in which her character wasn't exactly moral, but we do have these very predatory women like Marlena Dietrich or Greta Garbo and Barbara Stanwyck again. I mean, why was that?
Well, I think one explanation might be their fantasies of female empowerment in an era in which women have very little power, and especially economic power. And one way for women, traditionally, the old way to get ahead would be by using their sexual wiles and not being punished for it. And that's what happens during the code. Maybe the best example of a figure who does this, of course, is Mae West, who, sashays her way through any number of narratives and always gets the better of the men, both in terms of, witticisms and in terms of the economy as well.
And another aspect of film that was very controversial was a gangster film.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, gangster films, it wasn't just the violence of the gangster film that put off critics, and it might be difficult for us to recapture that if you look at a film like Little Caesar, Public Enemy, or Scarface. Those are the big three, the most controversial, the most influential. That in the context of the time, these films really were violent. And they don't, of course, by our standards, they seem, very, very placid. But audiences hadn't seen that mixture of sort of machine gun violence and ruthless killing before on the screen. Part of it is because sound had just come in, and sort of the roar of the Tommy gun and the screeching of tires had a visceral excitement for those audiences that we might miss today. And the fact that they are engaging in violent, chaotic behavior and succeeding seems to really unnerve political authorities. There was no genre more controversial than the gangster film. I think, a comparison today might be some of the arguments you have about violence in movies or on the internet, inspiring young people to, to go out and shoot their classmates in high school. There were that same kind of deep fear that these films had an incendiary and insurrectionist impact on American moviegoers. And in the era of the Great Depression, this is particularly urgent because this is really a time of social unrest and economic chaos.
We can imagine the effect that gangster films might have on people or that the predatory women might have, but even Tarzan and Jane got into trouble with the censors. How is that?
Tarzan and Jane, well, the best way they get into trouble with the censors, and the original, Tarzan and his mate, as it was called, and I mean, just think of the title. It's so, they're not a lawfully wedded couple. They're this sort of biological union, this Tarzan and his mate. That film had in early 1934, in the original cut, had a rather explicit nude underwater swimming scene. And that really sent people around the bend in what was not quite then the production code office. And that scene was largely excised, and Tarzan and His Mate becomes one of these pivotal films that give the production code administrators, or give the original censors in what was then called the Studio Relations Committee, power, because that film was so over the top in what it showed on screen that some forces in the even the studio moguls, I think, realized they might have gone a little too far with that one in the context of the time.
Well, along the lines of Tarzan and His Mate, we get to the topic of romance and love and sex and impure love. And what was the reaction of the censors to what they deemed impure love, and how did they define that?
Well, impure love was a euphemism in the production code for homosexual behavior. And in the early 1930s, you had a lot of insinuations and implications of homosexuality in some of the more wisecracking comedies and in some of the melodramas as well. And any reference to this in the context of the code after 1934 would tend to be very subsurface. So you actually, the phrase for it at the time was called pansy humor. And you'd have, basically the kind of stuff that maybe Nathan Lane would do today, a very kind of over-the-top raging queen would appear for a couple minutes in a comedy like Sailor's Luck. Example of this is in a Wild film with Clara Bow called Call Her Savage, in which she goes to some downtown cafe in New York, and there are a couple of homosexual waiters who flitter around and sing a little cabaret song.
And what about interracial relationships?
Well, interrelation, it depends on what races you're talking about, that there was a far greater degree of racial and ethnic mixing among the sexes and among, men in places like prison and overseas than you'd see after the code. So you get films that often the Chinese gentleman would be a figure of erotic attraction for the white female, usually played, of course, by a man in yellow face. A good example of this is maybe the Barbara Stanwyck film, The Bitter Tea of General Yen. There's also a great fascination with what would have been called the red man at the time, the American Indian, as a figure of erotic attraction. And there was a very famous man named Chief Buffalo Child Longlands, who pretended to be an Indian, and it was an object of erotic attraction for high society. It appeared in a couple of films. In terms of black-white relations, it's always much more concealed, and of course, in America, much more censored and repressed. You get almost no erotic charges between the sexes, although you do get some validation of the African-American as a strong figure in a couple of pre-code films. I guess the best known one is The Emperor Jones with the great black actor Paul Robeson.
And how successful, once the code is enforced in 1934, how successful was it in suppressing depiction of sin in cinema?
Oh, it was, the thing about the production code is that in Hollywood's terms, remember, in 1934, the choice isn't between Joseph Breen and the production code and under freedom of expression. It's between the production code, which is like an efficient, understandable, reliable, predictable form of censorship done in Hollywood, where you can do it, most cheaply, and a whole series of state, municipal censor boards, and perhaps the looming threat of federal censorship. So the production code worked in the sense that it kept the women's organizations and the religious organizations and the government off the back to Hollywood. They did the censorship themselves at the source. And so they thrive under the production code, economically at least, and certainly I think most of us would look back on that tradition from 1934 to about the mid-60s when, the code is finally abolished, as really a great artistic legacy as well. So for Hollywood's purpose, the production code was a good arrangement.
And we have only a moment left, but how did, for example, Psycho prove to be such a watershed in the code's demise?
Well, a lot of films defeat and crack the production code, but I always think in 1960, although the code isn't really formally ended until 1968, after Psycho, it's up for grabs. Psycho destroys the moral universe of the production code. It mixes sex and violence, and it does so in an atmosphere of total moral disorder, which is why people of that generation who grew up on the production code will tend to remember where they were when they saw Psycho, because it was so radically different from the production code universe that they had grown up on.
And especially since Hitchcock himself had come out of that universe originally.
Right, yeah. He's sort of the heretic within the universe.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Daugherty.
Hey, my pleasure.
We have been talking with Dr. Thomas Daugherty, chair of the Film Studies Program at Brandeis University and author of Pre-Code Hollywood, Sex, Immorality, and Insurrection in American Cinema, 1930 through 1934.
Because I told you before, oh, you can't do that.
We just heard about the struggle to control the content of American films in the early 1930s in what is known as pre-code Hollywood. Now we turn to the post-code era and the continued debate over censorship and free expression in American films. Here to give us his thoughts on that subject is Robert Sickles, professor of film history at Whitman College. Professor Sickles is the film and television review editor for the journal Film and History.
American cinema before 1934 is called the pre-code era, the period from 1934 to roughly 1967, the code era, and the period immediately thereafter, the post-code era. Then what era is Hollywood in now? I would argue that we are living in the time of the post-post-code era, a period in which the closest thing we have to censorship is the dreaded NC-17 rating. One wonders, how do these post-post-code era narratives differ from those of earlier time periods? A few things noticeably stand out. For one, there just aren't many double entendres anymore. Why have sexually charged repartee when your characters can literally say anything? And live-action musicals? They've gone the way of the dinosaur, replaced by animated Disney spectacles replete with singing lions, gargoyles, and candlesticks. And the thriller? That too is gone, as we're no longer thrilled by suspense. Taking its place is the action film, which has evolved to the point of being a kind of visual bludgeoning, with each succeeding sequence ostensibly meant to top the pyrotechnic virtuosity of the last, all at the cost of character development and story. Think Armageddon. What, then, are some of the defining characteristics of current Hollywood filmmaking? Well, it's essential to have crossover appeal, which in the movies is a different thing than being able to appeal to both the country and the rock and roll crowds. In the movies, crossover appeal means you want your film to attract a proven pre-existing television demographic. What's the formula for doing so? It's like this. Take a couple of existing hot young talents from a trendy Fox or WB television show, say Dawson's Creek, Party of Five, or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mix in a carefully packaged and marketed new beautiful young face, and add a slickly produced soundtrack in which the songs have nothing to do with the film, but are nevertheless the products of groups that have strong commercial track records with your target audience. Your story really doesn't matter so much as long as your principals are trendily dressed and stylishly coiffed, and you don't forget that the guy must get the girl. Or, if you're an edgy filmmaker, the girl must get the guy. Do these things and voila, you've succeeded in post-post-code Hollywood. If I sound cynical, I apologize. I actually love a number of recent Hollywood movies. In fact, I would argue that the best movies produced in this post-post-code era are every bit as good as the best films from earlier time periods. More important is the fact that many of the movies that I think are among the finest this new Hollywood has made are unique to the contemporary Hollywood milieu, and that they never could have been made in the earlier eras. Nevertheless, the fact remains that for every Boogie Nights, there is a Showgirls. For every Usual Suspects, 1,000 action films. And for each of Tarantino's movies, an endless supply of toothless knockoffs. I'll take the bad so long as the good still continues to make an occasional on-screen appearance, but I have to admit, every once in a while, as I sit in a darkened theater and watch yet another uninspired, lewd, witless, gratuitous film, I long for an earlier era, a time of cigar-chomping moguls, when inventive filmmakers circumvented the Hays Code with creative subtlety, and real people sang songs and danced with aplomb.
You've been listening to Robert Sickles, film and television review editor for the journal Film and History. This is Talking History. For our site of the week, we continue to focus on film history and recommend to you not a site where you can learn more about film, but where you can explore an archive of movie posters and even order a few for yourself. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Looking for that perfect gift for your friend, the movie buff? Trying to find that elusive old movie poster? Or can't afford what the local store is asking for one? Try the Movie Posters Archive on the web. Here you'll find a great collection of movie posters that you can download, ranging from the old sci-fi horror, The Blob, to classics like Ben-Hur, Casablanca, old movies, new movies, Italian movies. They're all here. With 452 movie posters to choose from, you're bound to find what you're looking for, and best of all, they're free. Just search for the Movie Posters Archive and click away.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. The John F. Kennedy Library and Museum is celebrating its 20th anniversary by opening to the public a special exhibit of many of its best holdings. Appropriately titled Treasures of the Kennedy Library, curators have dug into the archive's collection of more than 22,000 items and found many never-before-seen pieces related to John Kennedy, from the handwritten notes he took during the Cuban Missile Crisis to the gift of a long-lost copy of Michelangelo's Pietà. The exhibit runs through May 1st, but be sure to call the Kennedy Library Museum in Boston for further information. The History Channel has declared the week of April 3rd History, Crimes, and Trials Week. On four consecutive nights, the History Channel will take a look at how U.S. law enforcement has dealt with some of the most notorious criminals in history. On April 3rd, Manhunt examines the criminal systems dealing with political radicals in the 1960s. On April 4th, Cops and Robbers provides a history of American law enforcement. John Dillinger is the subject of the segment on April 5th, and on April 6th, the program focuses on Charles Manson. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will learn a little about the early history of beer. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.